Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Just a warning, there is reference to pregnancy loss in this episode, so please take care whilst listening. Hello and welcome to The Midpoint with me, Gabby Logan. Today I'm joined by one of the most decorated football coaches in the game. She has 13 major trophies to her name, including 6 Women's Super League titles. It can only be Emma Hayes. Emma has been at the helm of Chelsea's women's football team for nearly 12 years and has led them to back-to-back championships and historic doubles. But even with all those trophies, it's hard to put into words the impact that Emma has had on making women's football the sellout success it is today. You can't think of Chelsea without thinking of Emma Hayes, but she's off to pastures new at the end of the season, so we speak to her at a pivotal time, about to embark on a new adventure in midlife as head coach of the US women's national team, who are 4-time world champions. We're also joined by fitness coach Kate Roham to speak to her about the key points in her book, Owning Your Menopause, Fitter, Calmer, Stronger in 30 Days. That's the title of the book and the aim, obviously. But right now, let's meet Emma. Emma Hayes, thank you so much for coming on The Midpoint. I've been trying to get you on for a while and we've managed to find an hour in your incredibly packed schedule to chat all things midlife. So many exciting things happening for you in midlife. But I want to start on a quote that I read that you said last year, all the pieces were coming together for you and you're enjoying things again because for a while you weren't. And I thought back to when we worked together, do you remember we did a Liverpool game at Leicester? It was 2021, yeah. Christmas. And we were chatting there and I got a sense that you were kind of a little bit lost at that point in terms of whether or not you really wanted to stay day to day involved in women's football or whether punditry was going to be the thing you did or whether you actually said to me, I think I might just go back and work in business at some point. It felt like you were having a slight kind of moment of confusion or deliberation. Would I be right that that was a period of flux for you?
Well, I think if you'd ask most people questions about whatever it is they do, you're always contemplating, you know, how much longer am I going to do it for or what am I going to do next? So I don't think maybe that was unusual. But I'm someone who I'm always constantly looking for always enjoyment first. It's always enjoyment. I want to enjoy what I'm doing. And I think probably in the family I was raised in, you were never really allowed to sort of get too comfortable. So I think it's fair. It feels like a long time ago, to be honest with you. And I think so much has happened since then that I almost put my own personal, I guess, objectives aside.
And yeah, that quote about the pieces coming together, was that also to do with your health and well-being? Because you also have spoken a lot about your endometriosis and then obviously...
Yeah, I think so. I think because I suffered for such a long time without many answers and I've had to become self-taught. I've had to dig deep with my own research around... You know, why I felt. I've always felt let down by the system. Many women would say the same thing. But I think once I'd, you know, a little bit like, I think for all of us, when we have that lightning bolt moment where we connect all of the dots, I felt like I'd got to the end of maybe a long search around, you know, why I was feeling the way I did.
Yeah, because we had Emma Barnett on, who's talked a lot about endometriosis. And I think women who haven't suffered with it, in fact, you know, men listening will probably have no idea of how painful it can be, how debilitating it can be, how it can kind of take over a woman's life. And doing all of that while you're in a high profile, high pressure job, and one of your babies didn't make it, you had twins, and you're dealing with all of that, you know, in that the glare of the public kind of eye, which it's incredible. You carried on through that period. You had 8 weeks off work after you had Harry.
well, ask many women, you know, just they'll all be in the same position. And I think everything from, you know, not knowing any different, having to just get on. Maybe my mum's been such a champion at that, having three girls herself. And I don't really think my dad was a great help when we were children. So my role model was a mum who just got on with it, though she likes to remind us all of what she had to endure and suffer, I think being one of them. And maybe a little bit of guilt of, I used to say to myself, when I had Harry, I was thinking, give me a female manager that's taken a year off work and been able to go back into the same job. I felt that if I did do that, it would have been impossible for me to return to work because, quite rightly, the team would have moved on to another place. And I didn't feel like I had a choice, to be honest with you, with the industry I was in, that I could take more than the period of time I did take off. But I haven't had much time to breathe, I would say, in the last... I mean, Harry's coming up 6 in May. I don't think this whole entire period I've had much time to recuperate, get fresh again, you know, contemplate, do all of those things. So, but it is what it is.
But you carried on winning titles and being successful and building great teams in that period where you say you didn't have time really to kind of reset. So, you know, it was relentless, wasn't it? And it is relentless being a football manager. That strikes me as quite, I don't know, depressing in a way that, you know, you couldn't take more time because actually you make a great point. You wouldn't be able to get back into the job necessarily 8 months later if somebody else had made their mark on a team. That's never going to change then, is it? How can it ever change in the women's game or any woman managing?
It's true. I listened to an interview with Rachel Yankee this morning talking about supporting mothers in coaching. I mean, coaching in itself is a job that sometimes I wouldn't wish on anyone. Then to do that as a mum with great travel, which I've had for 12 years, I don't hold anybody responsible for it. It's not like the fault of anyone necessarily, but perhaps I could have been a bit more demanding about what I needed, seeing I was probably one of a few women that did it. But I guess, you know, you have to surround yourself with a great support network. For me, that's absolutely crucial. And many women who work in industries that are in own sociable hours have exactly the same challenges. So I always used to think, well, why should I have any more privileges? I shouldn't. But when you work so many weekends and you don't have any really regular, it's not a 9-to-5 job Monday, Friday, I think, to be honest with you, I've been on autopilot.
People... their perception of you would be somebody who would shout out and would ask for that and would demand, because you've been such a trailblazer and you've done so much pioneering work in this field. So if you, Emma Hayes, can't ask for that, who can?
Well, I've always been about shouting for others. Like, I've always thought of my place or my position as one where I'm a bit of a, I'll kick the door down for someone else sort of thing. And if I'm honest with you, that's been my role my whole life. It's my role in my family. I'm the middle child. I'm either breaking up the squabbling either side of me, my two sisters, but I'm always the one who, no, I'm happy to do that, to be honest with you. But there is no denying I neglected myself. No question whatsoever in that. And I think my mum, especially when my endo really, really hit, I'd call rock bottom. I remember coming back from the World Cup and I thought I'd turned a corner because I'd been in the off season. Mm-hmm. When really I was just
resting.
Was this
the men's World Cup when you were
Women's World
Cup. The Women's World Cup.
No, it was the end of the Men's World Cup. That's how I can't. This
that
is
was 2022.
This is a classic menopause moment. This is a classic brain fog.
So were you in Qatar?
No, last year. No, it wasn't last year. My dad died last year when I came back from the World Cup. The year before, when I came home from Women's Euros, No, it was the Women's World Cup the year before. Whatever it was, it was a major tournament.
Women's World Cup was last year. Men's World Cup was 22 and Women's Euros was 22. But anyway, at some major tournament, you had a moment.
I had a major moment. I came home and my mum said to me, you need to get this sorted. And Sally Harris, the doctor for the LMA, she's no ordinary doctor. She's a lifesaver. She had approached me at a dinner where I was a guest of Sir Alex Ferguson. Like, sorry for the name drop.
No, keep them coming.
And she came over and she threw down on the piece of paper her telephone number and she said to me, you're next. And I said, what do you mean? And when she left the table, I was sat with football managers who all talked about how she'd helped all of their own individual health.
And these were men and women?
All men. And I thought it was really telling. Anyway, this was in April. And then July, she contacted me. I said, I can't, I'm out of the country. She's like, when you come back, we'll get it sorted. So in September, I went to see her as an LMA health assessment, which they do for every football manager once a year. I walked in the door. She'd given me, you know, the once over and then the gynecological examination. She said, you need an emergency hysterectomy. And I was like, you're not even a gynecologist. But yeah. She'd sent me to someone, and within a matter of days, they're like, you've got stage 5 endometriosis. It's in a bad way. And I said, okay, let's go. Let's get it done. Took the time off, went in for a 90-minute surgery, and 5.5 hours later, the endo had taken over my whole body and caused a lot of damage. And, yeah, I think, I thought I was getting well. I was just telling myself I was just trying to soldier through pain. And then when I, 6 months later, I realised, oh, my goodness, that's what that pain was for all those years. It was endo. So taking that pain away was absolutely amazing. And as soon as I got well, I got a diagnosis of my dad's cancer. And so I was in another state again. So I feel like it's been a tough, really, personally for me, a tough couple of years.
Yeah, you were very close. You're a close family.
Yeah.
And that's something that a lot of us in midlife are going to have to face up to, losing parents, isn't it? But the time,
yes.
And there's never a good time, is there? Let's be honest.
But no, there isn't. But he championed me. He always used to say to me, make sure you stand up front. Make sure you say it out loud. Make sure you stick up for everyone else.
He sounds like a great father of girls.
Honestly, the best. And I think of the day and age women's football didn't exist. He was the one setting up Arsenal youth teams and getting all the kids off the street in inner city London and driving them around. He's always been a champion of girls and women. And he saw that I would be the one that would do whatever I've done. I personally didn't see it. But I'd always go back to him, especially around women's health. And I'd be like, Dad, I really want to. I think it's really, really important. There's so much I wasn't taught at school. I didn't know anything other than how to put a condom on a cucumber. That was sex education in Parliament Hill School. But, you know, I wanted to know, well, what do my ovaries do? What happens from puberty to menopause? And as so many women who I'm sure you are speaking to, because I do listen to the podcast, we've had to become self-taught around the things we don't know about ourselves.
What happens then after a hysterectomy in terms of your hormones?
Wow. I remember the first 10 days in hospital and entering sudden menopause. I'll never forget it. I was hallucinating in hospital. I'll never, ever forget those 2 days of hallucinating and climbing the walls because, one, the trauma of the surgery and an absolute, you know, disappearing of estrogen and, well, my hormones. My doctor really helped get me through that. And it took a period of time. I mean, listen, apart from the fact that you can't do the most basic of things from pee, let alone walk, from the first period, because it was quite a big surgery. I had to learn to do all of those basic things very, very slowly. And it was at a time when nobody was allowed to visit at the hospital by the team doctor at Chelsea. My son came, but he couldn't handle it. So I couldn't handle it, him visiting. And I remember sitting there for 10 days in the middle of central London and thinking, oh my goodness, I'm so lucky. I've been able to be whisked in here within the space of a week. And regardless of the fact that I've suffered for the length of time I have, there's so many more women that aren't going to have this privilege because I've got private healthcare. And it, my little cousin's was a midwife. She's now training to be a doctor. And we have so many family conversations around how many gynecologists there are, how many opportunities there are for gynecologists in this country, how little funding there really is put into this space. And I genuinely think we are sold so unbelievably short, not just when it comes to women's health, but the lack of gynecological support girls and women get is shocking. Shocking.
You're a fighter. You're somebody who speaks up about it as well. And as you pointed out, you're privileged to have the healthcare that meant you could get it done. And now you're back and you're doing what you love. How many women are lost out of the system, whatever they're doing, whatever, even if it's being an active member of their family, you know, and being the figure that everything revolves around, that's a travesty, isn't it?
Well, it's not just that. It's when you ask questions and someone will say to me, oh, my wife, she suffers with endometriosis. She's been on a waiting list for 24 months. And there is a clear pattern. I don't care what anyone says. There is a clear pattern between ridiculous wait times and diagnosis, not just endo, because I can speak from a perspective of endo, but we could talk about so many other conditions that go undiagnosed, that it's alarming and worrying at best. And I used to always think to myself, why did women, you know, there's many reasons why women from Victorian age below died in midlife. But when your hormones are affected in such a way, whether they're escalating out of control because of certain conditions or in the case of a sudden menopause, without the right support, you can totally understand, one, why women top themselves, and two, why they die at much earlier ages. Because if we don't get those things right, the plethora of things from, you know, and of course, not enough research is done in and around our health and our brains and the decline, the cognitive decline for us. There's this I always keep asking the question, why do more women die of heart disease and dementia than men? There is a clear correlation somewhere. And why are we robbed and sold so unbelievably short when we pay, you know, equal amounts in our national security, you know, national insurance and taxes, that it's significantly underfunded?
So when you got yourself kind of out of hospital and back into daily life, were you then on hormones? Were you given estrogen?
I was from the very beginning, because when I started to hallucinate, I couldn't handle that. Mm. I won't lie, there was some very trippy moments in hospital, which were enjoyable momentarily until I had to sleep. You know, climbing walls, literally felt like I was climbing walls, was an interesting moment. But then when
just
I realised...
But that, Emma, just shows you how powerful hormones are.
I was levitating out my bed. I could feel myself. And I said to the doctor, I was like, you have to help me. I said, I haven't slept, which I understand I've had a big surgery and I can't sleep. But that first period was so, so tough. I remember feeling really depressed, really just, I just wanted to be on my own. And then having to go home, and I mean, my family, they are a godsend. My mum practically moved in with me and really, really nurtured me during that period. And she had a hysterectomy too, at exactly the same age, for endo. And she really, really helped me through it, really, really helped me through it. So I was like, I was teary. I couldn't stop crying. I felt afraid. I just couldn't do things that were so normal for me. And it took 6 weeks, I'd say. And I got a little bit restless. But I 6 weeks, I had no desire to return to work on a daily basis.
Were there days when you thought you never would?
Yeah. I think if, 100%. I think if I'd had more financial security in many of these moments, I would have taken different decisions at different times. But I don't have that luxury. contrary to, you know, being a successful football manager, I can't afford to take a year off work in what I do. So, and when you're responsible for a household and a child, like I said, I feel bad talking about it from my perspective, because I always think I'm always in a privileged place, but the reality is it's no different. My position, I don't have millions of pounds to be able to say I can do this or that, but private health insurance absolutely gave me at least a chance to heal in the best way possible.
And Sally, the doctor from the...
Sally Harris, Emma Brockwell, a pelvic floor specialist who now works with us at Chelsea. She was pivotal in the very early days, because you can't do things like turning over, let alone getting up was difficult. You can't, you know, cutting through several layers of your stomach. So she taught me how to build my core strength again in the most basic ways. And that then triggered something else around the importance of pelvic floor. And then not pelvic floor in just women who have had hysterectomies or had babies, but in general, why pelvic floor is absolutely essential for women, because of our issues with leakage. You know, it happens to more than 50% of any woman at any age. And if you don't get those things right, you have to deal with them later on in life. So I've tried to take the best, and a breath coach. Oh, my goodness, the importance of learning the value of breath and how that influences pelvic floor. Both meditation and breath work have been probably my lifesavers in my most anxious moments, and particularly during the stages straight after hysterectomy.
So when you look back at that, which is not so long ago, it's amazing that now you're in this position with a few months to go remaining as Chelsea manager, that you will then be taking on what I think is the biggest job in the world in female sport. I think being the head coach of the US women's team, I can't think of a bigger position in women's sport. I mean, obviously, if a woman was the head of the IOC or something like that, but I mean, that's incredible.
I know. Honestly, it's my best mate, Kirsty Peeling. We've been friends since we were 12, and we grew up playing football together. And when I couldn't afford to buy my own flat, my mum and dad sold their council flat, and they gave me 40 grand. And they said, you could, you know, put it towards, and I couldn't buy anything. So my best mate and I bought a flat in Camden, and it's before children and life, serious life anyway. When we used to come home after a night out in Camden, we used to like play out what it would be like leading a team in the Olympics. And maybe we probably had one too many. And I used to walk the flag around the front room, and we used to commentate about it, almost childlike. We've been mates since we were kids. And I never forget that moment when I picked up the phone to her and I said, "Pal, you won't believe what job I've been offered." She was like, "Huh?" You know, in fact, her dad died 2 weeks after mine. So we were both grieving heavily. And she just, I could hear her tears down the phone. And she was like, "Oh, Emma, I can't believe it. I can't believe you've got the one job you really, really wanted, you know, for a long time." And I said, I don't know what to, I feel so torn. I feel guilty.
Why? Why would you feel guilty?
I think a couple of things. I think because one, it's been really clear how much I've loved Chelsea. And so that's been a family in itself. The thought of leaving them or abandoning them was tough. My mum, who was grieving, I couldn't even talk to her about it. My family didn't want any conversation around USA, because for them it was like, oh my God, she's going to go again. So I had to sort of keep that to myself. And then I think Harry, I think I was on one level, I'm like, it's an adventure. And I'm like, his cousins live on the next street. Adventure, they live on the next street. Adventure. And it was just constant.
How long did that process go on for before you decided, yes, I'm going to do this?
Well, they courted me from directly after sort of the World Cup, or maybe the beginning of September. And it wasn't until maybe the end of October. I think, to be honest, if in fact, now I reflect on it, I just about made up my mind up when the story broke. I was still all over the place. But because I didn't want my players to hear it from anyone else, I sort of had to speak prematurely about something.
In an ideal world, would you have liked to have got through the season? Because it's quite hard, isn't it, having that kind of news out there, you know? But
I was grieving. I was on autopilot. So everything for me just felt like I just hadn't, my emotions have felt really dulled down. So I was like, how the hell can I make an important life decision in one way or another? And then my dad just kept popping up in my head. Got to take it, girl. You got to take it. Because he was what he would have said to me 1,000 times over. You've got to go. So I think that kind of got me through it, even if my family really, at the time, were dealing with their own stuff. So, yeah. And then obviously when the story broke, I just went into cover. I've had everybody contact me, from friends, 10 years of working out in the US, best friends who were like, why haven't you told us? And to players I've coached, and it just, I had to shut down. I shut off everything off. I couldn't cope with it, to be honest.
And then the exciting part is obviously the new life. I mean, it's not just, you know, taking another club in Europe, or, you know, going to Lyon or something like that. This is moving continents, you know, and setting up home somewhere else, which I think, you know, that's that adventure and that kind of spirit of adventure that you've got to have to do that, I think is so important. And in, you know, that we keep those things going inside. It's how we live, isn't it? It's all life.
I've always wanted to do it for Harry. I always said, I lived abroad for 10 years. I will do it at some point.
So where's home going to be? Where do you actually base yourself?
It will be Atlanta, where the National Training Center will be. It's an international airport, so I can come back. And I don't want to, listen, and I want to say this to any of the American people listening to this, please don't mistake all of what I have experienced leading up to taking that decision without understanding its context, because as much as I felt anxiety, doubt, terror, I had to experience joy and excitement all at once. And you have to almost sort of sit there, and I wrote a pros and cons list, and just pros, Olympics, pros, World Cup, pros, travelling, pros, coaching the best
players,
team in the world. Yeah. Like, what an unbelievable baton to be handed. It's like I can't, you know, and I know I'll get more and more excited once that comes to an end, but I just have to try and compartmentalise it for now.
And in a country where women's football has always been held in high esteem because of the history and the development of football in that country, they've kind of grown together, men's and women's football, haven't they? You know, and one wasn't there a long time before the other. So it's very unusual, isn't it, the way soccer has developed in America. And women's football's obviously had a professional platform for a long time. So you're not having to go in and kind of, you know, build up from the ground. Obviously, you'll be involved, I imagine, in things, the decisions that kind of take place about the development of the game in America, but the structures are so enviable, aren't they?
Well, when I think about what I've been able to influence at home, so much of that inspiration has come from the US anyway, because it was pretty normal to have a player on your team who had a baby who travelled with you, for example. It wasn't, I hear some horror stories, I think, and I won't lie, one of the biggest selling points to me was how they made Harry feel. You know, it was like, well, Harry can come on camp, and, you know, these, it wasn't sort of, I didn't have to broach the subject as so many women have to do. It was almost like, oh, that's a non-negotiable. That's the easy part.
He's really up for this, isn't he?
He was well up for it. He was so mature from him. It was the last thing I expected, sitting up on his pillow and saying, oh, mummy, let's do it. Let's go to the USA. I really want to go. And I just cried and I hugged him and said, really, darling, really, you want to do this? He's like, yes, let's do this. And then I realised when the US press officer asked him, "What's your favourite state, Harry?" And he said, "Disneyland." And I thought, okay. But listen, I think my sisters have never left London. And for them, they're like, "Well, Harry's going to be leaving this all behind." And I was like, but I have left and I know what it's like. And this is what I want for my life. And I want him to have that adventure up until 10. You know, I've got 5 years where I'm happy to create alternative situations for him, as long as I get it right by the time he enters secondary school. I'm okay with it, and yeah. So is he.
And they'll come out and see you all the time, won't they, family?
They will. They're over that part now. I think it was hard at the beginning, but totally understandable. Like, we needed each other in that period, and Dad was so big for us all, and we've sort of rallied round each other. And they're now excited. I think they would have been torn, sorry, Serena, if GB had qualified for the Olympics, but now at least, you know, they can sit.
So when do you actually take over? What's the date that you have agreed?
Probably a couple of days of the season ending.
Yeah. Getting them ready for the Olympics, basically.
Yeah, no, to be honest with you, I wouldn't want it any other way. Like, I'm serious about winning and serious about competing. And while I know there's, you know, transition from a younger generation coming through, I want to give it everything I've got until the Olympics, and then I'll take a break directly after the Olympics.
Yeah. Well, the Olympics will be energising, I'm sure. I'll see you in Paris.
You know, you've been to enough of them.
It is the best. I mean, I was at school yesterday, primary school kids, a friend's head teacher there, and asked me to go in and talk to them about the Olympics. And I was getting myself kind of emotional just talking about it. You can see these kids are 5 years old looking at me, because I pulled out a few of my favourite Olympians, and one of them is Catherine Granger, because of her perseverance for going for gold, yeah. You know, three silvers and then the gold. And I felt the hairs at the back of my neck kind of go up because of what Olympics and the Olympic kind of spirit means, you know, and just it's such an exciting few weeks.
What's your favourite part of the Olympics?
There's always, I was saying to these kids yesterday, there's so many sports and so many different opportunities for all different shapes and sizes of humanity to compete in Olympic Games. You go in Olympic Village and there's everything from a 7 foot man to a 4 foot two girl who's probably vaulting, you know, and it's the people and the stories, the moments that just suddenly get you, you know, where you hear a backstory about somebody and what happened to them in the year before and how they, you know, had missed out on a qualification and something got them there, and then suddenly they're overachieving in that environment. And it's just that kind of human spirit that I think is so, it's, and obviously there are certain sports that are professional going into the Olympics, like tennis and golf. And nowadays, obviously, women's football is much more kind of, so many more of those players are paid, you know, compared to kind of the past, where it was the pinnacle, wasn't it, to go to an Olympics in terms of their professional life. But actually, it doesn't matter, because what I think Justin Rose showed me in 2016, when he won the Olympics, I was a bit cynical about golf, kind of thinking, these guys play like these huge championships, this doesn't mean anything. You could see with Justin Rose, it was enormous. Yeah. And Andy Murray with tennis, you know. And
yeah,
so,
great example.
Yeah. And I think those guys have kind of given my cynicism about those really professional sports being there a bit of a kind of jolt, and realise actually, once you're there, it's what it means to, you know, to be in that environment with all those people. And yeah, so you're gonna have the best time.
And I know what it means to America. Hmm. Having lived there, the public absolutely love the Olympics, and that's why I won't waste 1 minute. I will do everything I can for that team.
They are the most successful nation in terms of medals and gold medals. So yeah, you can see they put a lot into it.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Right, we're going to bring in our expert now. And she is somebody who has had some pretty wretched years with her perimenopausal symptoms, but has turned that all around and has been a real positive kind of role model and influencer in this space. Kate Roham is with us. She's a fitness instructor who's recently written Owning Your Menopause, Fitter, Stronger and Healthier in 30 Days. So I think, Emma, your story obviously will resonate with a lot of people. And Kate, well, you've been on the podcast before, of course, and we've talked about how you got to grips with your perimenopause. But what I love about your new book is the practicality of it, the takeaway kind of advice for people. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's really lovely to be here. And I've really loved the conversation you've had. It's been really inspiring. But much like you, Emma, yeah, my backstory is I found myself in perimenopause with very little information, very little support, and felt very lost, very alone, and actually was diagnosed with depression, and slowly worked out what was happening and realized I was 41 in menopause. I have a young child, my youngest actually now is Rupert, who's 7. So it was kind of that stage where I went from sort of motherhood with a young baby, like straight into these sort of experiencing menopause. And I was kind of doing everything wrong, I guess. I was probably drinking too much. I was exercising the wrong way. I, even as a fitness instructor, didn't know what we should be doing. And it was exactly that. I wanted to try and gift women with the tools to be able to actually help themselves. What can they do today rather than, as you've said, waiting for an appointment, waiting for help? What can they implement? And that was kind of where the book was born, was a practical guide with a 30-day plan. And they can start from a beginner level, moving their body, eating well, and making those holistic changes. And actually, it was funny when you mentioned breath work, because I actually have a breath work coach who teaches 3 sessions in the sort of on-demand part, because again, I think we need to look at the whole encompassing way of managing menopause.
Yeah, and not everybody can use HRT for various reasons. Some people don't want to either. So it's not a panacea. So it's important, I think, to understand that there's a holistic approach, isn't there? And there are all kinds of things that are going to work for different people. What have you found are the central kind of tenets of what your book is based around? There's the breath work, obviously exercise. What are you recommending?
Lifting weights.
Lifting.
I know we always come on to that one, but I think we are such a generation of women where, you know, these HIIT workouts, they're great, they're effective for time poor women, but we need to be building our muscle mass. We need to be focusing on our bone health. And Emma, you talked about pelvic floors. I've got lovely Claire Bourne, who actually does a little piece as well on pelvic floors, because I think a lot of women, as they come into this life stage, if they are suffering from any incontinence, any pelvic floor health issues, they are often, there's that misconception that they can't lift weights, which then obviously can then trigger that likelihood of potentially the onset of osteoporosis, osteopenia. They're not building that strength and that muscle. And, you know, muscle's the largest organ in the body. It helps with everything. It's there for longevity. So really the focus of the book is getting women to reframe as well how they see themselves. I think we focus, or a lot of women focus so much on the aesthetic benefits of exercise. But if we can kind of reframe our why, and mine is to live kind of as long, independently for as long as possible on my own. And Emma, resonating with your story, my dad also died 2 years ago from pancreatic cancer. And he was given 6 to 8 weeks to live, and he lived for 18 months. And that's because he was outside, he was fit, he was healthy. And I credit, I had a great time with him because he put himself in the best possible place to be. And I think that's what I want for the book. I want it to give people hope, those stories that, you know, if we do get a diagnosis of something, or we do have to go to surgery and major surgery, or if we find, you know, because this life stage does present all of those things, if you are stronger, fitter and healthier going into it, you've got a better chance of kind of coming back, or perhaps, you know, increasing your longevity. And for me, it's the strength training, again, mentally, that has just changed. I know even the morning that my dad died, I'd literally been by his bed. And I went and I did a weighted session, and it was the first time in a long time that I totally stopped thinking about what was going to happen to him. I was in, my body and my brain were in unison, and I had a moment of peace and a moment of calm before, obviously, you know, the grief and all of that hits you. So I guess it's just trying to empower women, and it's something that they can do. You've talked about sort of the accessibility of it, and you know, I think we don't need expensive gym memberships, we don't need expensive gym equipment, we can do these workouts from home, and we need to give every woman, regardless of the social demographic, whatever the background, that opportunity to feel like they can also manage this life stage.
Do you do weights, Emma?
Yes, and I've just bought a foldable treadmill because walking and incline walking for me has been, whenever I get time, I will do those things, but I want more time to do it. And I know that I've got little windows to do it. And I grab, and then I would always do 15 minute weight sessions. So I know that I've only got 15 minutes. I don't waste time with them. I think they've been invaluable. I couldn't agree more that without them, I think I'd have been in a worse place. And they certainly, if for those of us that don't have time to go to the gym, it's really, really easy to do with free weights, kettlebells, a bar. You can have the basic equipment, you know, if you want that, bands, and have mini little sessions. You don't always have to be big ones.
A lot in a small space as well, I think. You know, I've mastered the art of the hotel room workout and using a chair even. I did this one where I just thought, I've got a chair basically, what can I do with it? You know, and I was like, turned it into a workout. You can be so inventive and get such a good workout from a small space. And I think that's the important thing, to make it as democratic as possible, which is what your book is aiming to do, Kate, which is great.
Yeah, thank you. I hope so. I mean, it is, you know, it's hard out there, because motivating people when they are experiencing some really debilitating symptoms can be really difficult, but it's taking those tiny baby steps. And I think that's the thing. Sometimes we want to achieve so much, or we maybe want a quick fix, or we want that solution just to be around the corner. But I think, you know, what I hope women can see is sort of with that 30-day plan, like literally the day one workout on the beginner's level is, as you say, like Emma, like it's 10 minutes. And it's just encouraging people to just see that how even after 30 days they can make these changes. And again, you know, nourish their body. We could sit here all day and talk about it, but we have got such a disordered view of food. And, you know, with this diet and that diet, I think women don't know how to eat sometimes, or how to move. And so that's what I hope is just a nice practical guide on just cut back all of that nonsense, go back to basics and build those foundations and just keep going.
It's the first step, isn't it? It's, you know, being committed to something and saying, right, I'm going to be, you know, accountable to this, and 30 days feels doable. You know, it does feel like a period of time that you're saying, yeah, I can see the end of the month, and I can factor this into my diary. And, you know, which is something I've always tried to do at the beginning of the week. I look and go, right, where am I going to get the workouts in? You know, kind of plot them and then say, no, I can't do that meeting at 4 because I've already committed to this, you know, to this half an hour. And it's that being a bit selfish, isn't it? And saying, I need that because I'm not going to be as good for everybody else if I don't get that. I was listening to an interview this morning with the incredible parents of the boy Barnaby, who was killed in Nottingham last year, and the mum who was talking about how they're having to campaign for the killer to get a longer sentence said something about, she said, I know it's a cliche, she said, but you know, when you're on a plane and they talk about the oxygen mask, you've got to look after yourself first. And she said, you know, this is what we're experiencing right now, that, you know, I've got to kind of think about us and me and how we get through this. And actually, I think that's very relevant in this period of life, isn't it? You've got to think, without your oxygen mask on and you looking after you, others around you aren't going to end up benefiting. So it's just taking that time and not seeing it as selfish and not being guilty. Emma, a word you've used a few times.
I know. That's why mastering stress hormones, you can't underestimate them. That's why for me, the power of meditation and breath, sometimes I do it on the touchline. Sometimes I'll do it during a game. Yeah, 100%.
Really?
Yeah, I feel if I feel my anxiety levels are increasing, I will apply some basic breath work and strategies to keep my stress hormones calm. But it's the same. Once you understand the roller coaster that they are and putting in place the right things in the right moments, that's the other thing, is the recognition of, am I in... Does my body and mind need something that's going to calm me down and cool me off? But what I've learned is just, you know, not pounding your body, making sure you do the right things, walking is unbelievably good for you, but so is the ability to lift weights, and you can do it in little chunks. You don't always have to. People always say, "Oh, it's exercise is a long period of time." You don't have to. You can chunk things as well. You just have. I like the fact that you schedule it. I wish I'd be a bit more disciplined and maybe actually get my PA to just lock it in and just say it's a meeting with myself, because I could probably do that. And I think if I did that a little more, I'd be more disciplined with it. Particularly in the afternoons, I struggle in the afternoons to exercise.
I do try if I can to get it done in the morning, just to kind of know it's done, you know. But and it's harder when, you know, my kids are older. Harry's still school age, and you know
that's why I struggle in the morning, because he's like, he wants to play. I mean, he is Star Wars crazy at the minute, but he and fair enough. That's he doesn't see me after school, so no. He wants between 7 and 8:45. He wants that time for him. And it all ends up happening is you just keep sacrificing yourself all of the time. And so sometimes I just take the 15-minute chunks, 7 p.m. I have to accept I don't want to do it then, but I might accept it in that window.
Yeah. Kate, best of luck with the book. We will see you again sometime, I'm sure. Thank you so much for coming on today. Take care.
Thank you very much for having me. Thanks, Emma. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Bye.
Emma, I deliberately avoided talking kind of about the detail of the league this year and Chelsea and, you know, because also I want this to be an episode that people can listen to anytime and not go, you know, oh, what are they doing that week in the league? However, there is one area which I think is interesting. You've been affected again this week with an ACL injury as we speak. And it has been, over the last year, shocking, actually, the number of players who've had ACLs. And some players are talking about the amount of games that, you know, that they're playing. But there has to be kind of some deeper science and some deeper research into this, surely, to understand kind of why this is happening. And what is it? Is it the amount of games? Is it the kind of training women are doing that's not right for their bodies? Where are you on this? And what kind of science are you kind of privileged to see in reports that you're understanding are coming through?
Well, I think the first thing to say is, and it is the most important, is that it's multifactorial. I don't think it's one thing. However, let's talk about 25 years coaching, you know, and just experiencing it from a coaching perspective. Two things are really, really clear to me. One is hormones and the fact that we experience, you know, the way our bodies are shaped, our cue angles, can't do anything about that. That's what we are. Plus, we have joint laxity in different periods of the month. In a much different way. The vast majority of big injuries, particularly the ACL, I will see a big relation, a correlation between when they are done, when those injuries happen, and when the body and the joints might be a little bit more lax. Plus, we've done 5 years of research at Chelsea around injuries occurring within 9 days of there being an environment change. So if they go from their club team to international or international to their club team. So if I take Mia's injury within a couple of days, or 5 days, Sam Kerr within a couple of days of of the winter break, Anique Nowen during international break, during the changes. I'm sure if you go back to Beth Mead, it was within that same period after international break. Etc. I think, and this is why I've always go back to the scheduling, it's less so about the volume for me and more so about timings plus recovery. So if you think the last three calendar years, the women's football calendar during COVID has been absolutely horrific for the players. They've had no big off-season. When I mean big off-season, I'm talking like 1 month plus. It's been 2 weeks here after a season, 2 weeks after a major event. It's not enough. And it hasn't been enough. I also don't think it's a coincidence that, and I actually wrote about this in my book, if this happened to male players where the men's game had lost Mbappe plus Ronaldo plus Messi all at once, and we have to talk about it like that when you lose the players that have been lost to that injury, is scandalous. So I think environment changes. So I've always been I am absolutely an advocate of make periods with their club longer, so like a 3-month period. Then make periods with the international team longer. And here's why. You train a certain way in club. You then go to your national team, and let's say 20 of my players go from Chelsea to wherever. They all do completely different schedules because they've only got 5 days before a game. So there is, so body has got into some sort of routine. You then add flying, inflammation markers. You then add where the stage they are in their mm-hmm. menstrual
in their own cycle.
Then the number of games and training sessions they've had in the last 1, 2, 3 years, all of those things become factors. Change of surface, boots, for me, they're minimal. They're minimal for me.
It's the environment that's more... I think
environment and hormones. So the science, at least, so do we do preventative work? Absolutely. Do I think there is a link between the women's game being pro, but all of those players have never really come through a pro youth setup like the boys have? Yes. I think there's a correlation there.
Yeah, because they're not conditioned in that way through that period, are they?
Maybe so. With strength training, maybe with certain things like, you know, they start strength training when they become adults, where perhaps they had to start them slightly younger. We don't produce as much testosterone. That's the other thing. So is there a link between a lack of testosterone and that injury? I think it's all of them. I don't think it's one or the other. And I don't think this can solely be left science. I think that might be where the mistakes have been made.
Just to look at empirical evidence through one lens Correct. Is not going to actually get you...
You have to talk to the people who are delivering, like, what do the football sessions look like? Like, is there enough knowledge and experience in the loading pieces? Like, I sit there and I say, well, you know what? On a daily basis, ideally, every woman should be tested for inflammation markers. So whether it's, you know, pricks in the ear, you know, blood markers, we should be tested every day for that. Because if our inflammation is up, plus we have joint laxity, plus.
Then you shouldn't be doing this session.
Correct.
Yeah.
So, and that's why, plus you don't get the value of sleep, etc. Plus the value of nutrition. Have you had an anti-inflammatory diet during the period of joint laxity, etc. So I don't think it will go away. I think until we look at it in a very holistic way, not just, oh, here's a FIFA plus warm-up, or here's why. No, it's too simplistic. There has to be a collection of people together, including physios, coaches. Everybody has to pilot pieces. The reality is it'll take us years, perhaps when the youth section may take us another decade.
A decade or another generation to kind of come through.
Yes, yeah. I think so. I think we have to, but I also think there is a little bit of like confirmation bias with it, because I think they're still happening in the men's game, the same volume. I think we don't choose to look. We look at it like it's a women's football thing. It isn't. It happens a lot in the men's game. However, there's 6-month injuries in the men's game. They are 11-month injuries in the women's game. That, for me, become the fundamental differences. We might get certain type of muscle injuries. I don't see the same volume of groin injuries in the women's game that I do in the men's game. So, you know, there's just differences, and we need to be a little more, we need to zoom out a little bit more with our lens and put together a group of experts in a more profound way, longitudinally. In my opinion.
And it's being, you know, the hormonal effect on training and injuries is being talked about in other sports as well. Dina Asher-Smith spoke out at the Olympics, didn't she? Was at the World Championships when she spoke about why certain injuries she has, you know, succumbed
to. Yeah, I talked to her about it.
Of the season.
I spoke with her about it. She spoke about the impact for her, and she said, Emma, I wish I'd had a menstrual cycle coach. And that's where I think they become valuable. But I also think it's not just about a menstrual cycle coach. It's experts in and around female physiology. Like, it's all of it. It's, and I keep asking the same questions. Do we have enough qualifications? Is there enough in academia? Can young people grow up going to learn around female physiology to bring that expertise back in? I don't think it's there. We're all having to learn on the job.
And I'm sure when you get to the States as well, you'll find there's probably other bodies of work being done on this in, you know, because it's such an interesting, if you're a sports scientist, for me, this is the area you want to be looking at right now. It's going to be, I think, probably revolutionary, isn't it, over the next decade or so in terms of how we look at women's sport.
I think it's what we will do in the US. I think we will do some of that work when we go to Atlanta.
Yeah. Which is coming soon, and we're all, I think, very excited for you. I think I don't think there's a football fan who didn't, you know, as much as Chelsea fans will be devastated to lose you, I think as football fans we're so excited for you, because
you
know what a huge job it is, what an opportunity, and also proud, you know, you're one of ours.
Thanks.
And you're going over there and doing that. So
thanks,
Emma
Kate.
Hayes, thank you, and best of luck with your new job.
Thank you.
It was so great to get some time with Emma. She's about to embark on this really exciting opportunity. And then to hear her speak so openly and honestly about her health struggles as well. The player care and training schedules that she's implemented in women's football are so important. The US women's international team are going to be in very safe hands. And a huge thanks to Kate Roham too. You can grab a copy of her book, Owning Your Menopause, right now. And if you enjoyed this episode, please share it far and wide. And you can also hit follow wherever you listen, so you never miss an episode when it drops. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Spiritland Creator for putting this episode together. Same time next week, I'll catch you then.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.